Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. The rates of cesarean section surgeries in the United States have increased from 4.8 in 1968 to 29.1 in 2004, and they're still going up. Even if you consider the increase in population, this is a staggering statistic. And according to the CDC, the United States ranked 28th in the world in infant mortality in 1998. Have women just forgotten how to give birth? And why does labor take so long for United States women? What has our industrial approach to medicine done to one of women's most precious and valued experience, bringing new life into the world? Today we learn how changes in the birthing process have decreased the health of mothers and their children. We're joined by midwife and nurse Constance Miles, M-I-L-E-S. Stay tuned. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D.
Thank you, Lena. People in the United States can look forward to a future of ill health. I say this not because the medical care system, euphemistically yet universally referred to as the healthcare system, is failing under the weight of overdiagnosis and overtreatment, but because our political culture has, for quite some time now, entirely abandoned caring for those least capable of caring for themselves, mostly children. Last week, the McClatchy newspapers published an analysis of recent census data on poverty here in the land of opportunity. Poverty is increasing. In fact, it's been increasing for almost three decades. Despite economic growth and increased worker productivity, the fruits of that growth have been harvested almost exclusively by the owning classes. Meanwhile, the number of people in severe poverty, with half the income of the official poverty level, has increased steadily, and the number of people with an income greater than twice the poverty level has steadily declined. What's being done to alleviate this suffering? Perhaps you'll remember the Welfare Reform Act of 1996, championed by then-President Bill Clinton and happily passed by a Republican Congress. Its ostensible purpose was to reduce welfare expenditures and get people into the workforce where they could build their self-esteem on a minimum wage job that becomes, on a minimum wage that becomes smaller each year in real buying power. Yesterday, the Associated Press reported on how this happy scheme is working. It's failing. Although cash payments have declined, spending on other programs like Medi-Cal and food stamps have more than compensated so that total spending is higher than the old welfare system would have been. What's more, that spending would explode if all the people who are eligible participated. One study estimates that only 10% of eligible people apply for these supplemental programs. As to entering the happy world of the workforce, struggle is as good as it gets. Grim and stuck are more accurate descriptions of the descent into poverty experienced by, mostly, single mothers and their children. The economics is quite plain. Tax dollars are subsidizing businesses in yet another way by creating an underclass forced to work for dirt. Instead of enforcing a living wage, people, again, mostly single mothers, are forced to struggle with a combination of low wages at jobs without benefits and little security, while various government programs provide them with food, shelter, and medical care. There are some obvious effects on health. For example, being forced to choose between medical care and some necessity like rent and heat. There are less obvious and much longer-term effects from this abandonment. There's a well-documented relationship between income security and health. In a nutshell, the stress of insecurity promotes inflammation that in turn promotes illness. But it goes beyond that. Children who experience stress are more likely to have pro-inflammatory health effects as adults, regardless of the stressors they experience as adults. Recent research has identified the process that causes this. Our abandonment of children and their mothers to poverty is cursing their future, and their numbers are growing. The old welfare program was called Aid to Families with Dependent Children. The idea was that children, particularly preschoolers, should have a full-time parent at home with them. Typically, that meant the child's mother. The science supports that as very desirable for everyone. All gone now, and by and large, due to the same people who espouse family values. Many years ago, I was enjoying lunch at Cal College on the UC Santa Cruz campus with some faculty members. The family values crowd came up, and someone captured their ideology by saying, "Life is sacred before birth. After that, you're on your own. Welcome to the land of opportunity. Get ready for a whopper of a medical bill." For a copy of this transcript, go to our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, and go to the blog. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD, is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who works with individuals. He co-produces this radio show and is editor of the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine. You can reach him by going to our website, or you can call him directly at 707-874-1496. A brief announcement before we continue with our show, Caesarean Epidemic. Dr. Fawcett and I will be doing a two-hour lecture event in Berkeley this Sunday, March 4th, from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m., called Protect Yourself from Stress-Related Illness. To find out more, go to our website or call 707-874-2772, the website again, yourownhealthandfitness.org. And now to our show, Caesarean Epidemic, and I'd like to introduce my guest who's here in studio. Constant Miles is a California licensed midwife and registered nurse. She's also a nationally certified professional midwife. Constance has a master's degree in psychology and is a certified hypnotherapist. She has a thriving home birth practice in Sebastopol in Northern California and works one day a week as a women's health service provider at Oakland Women's Choice Clinic. Constance has been involved with birth for 35 years. She's birthed all four of her now adult daughters at home and assisted with the home births of all three of her granddaughters. That's amazing. Welcome. I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Okay. How's that?
No, that's not happening for some reason. Jeffrey, can you see whether this line in thing is pushed down? No, on the side there. If there's a line in pushed down?
Yeah.
Okay, Constance?
Yes.
Okay, push it up then, Jeffrey. Okay, try it again.
Okay.
There. We're not used to having so many bodies in the studio. So welcome to you.
Thank you.
We were going to start with a little bit of history about cesarean procedures, including the sort of political shift that occurred in relationship to them. Do you want to go ahead and give people some background on how we ended up with this just huge increase?
Okay, in 1983, Nancy Wehner Cohen then, she's Nancy Wehner now, and currently is a certified nurse midwife, she co-authored a book with Lois Essner called Silent Knife, in which they spoke about cesarean prevention, the risks of the procedure, and they stated that the risk of a uterine rupture with a vaginal birth after cesarean was less than 0.5%. Since then, technology has enabled physicians to detect problems earlier, and there also has been a statement issued by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, ACOG, stating that the risk of a vaginal birth after cesarean was so great that there needed to be a surgeon or an anesthesiologist in-house 24 hours, 7 days a week. And most hospitals cannot afford to do this.
So what we're saying is that somewhere along the line, cesarean births were introduced, and then it was very hard to get rid of them because there was this statistic that came up that said after women have a cesarean, that's it. They can only deliver by cesarean. What you're saying is, in fact, that's not the case, that there's a book about this, and that women can conceive and have healthy vaginal births after cesarean, but that people don't know that, so they're just sort of roped into doing them time after. Once you've had one, it's like, that's it. Huh?
Well, this was true for quite some time, and there are many midwives throughout the state, licensed midwives, who have assisted women at home having vaginal birth subsequent to cesarean and delivering larger babies. Some of these women did not have the emotional support that they needed going through their first labor. Perhaps they were young and were not educated, hadn't had childbirth education. Some of these women may have experienced some form of abuse earlier on and had a body memory but not a conscious memory, and so the intensity of the labor was a trigger for terror. And if a woman is fearful in labor, what happens is catecholamines are produced,
the hormones,
the stress hormones, and they shunt the blood to the arms and the legs. Mm-hmm. They shunt them, the circulation, away from the uterus so that the woman, it's the fight or flight response.
Right.
The woman can run from the tiger, run from danger. Mm-hmm. And then the uterus is left with incoordinate, irregular contractions. And the uterus gets tired, the woman gets tired, the baby gets stressed out, and it's a downhill
spiral. So what you're saying is that part of the reason it happens isn't just that women are hypnotized into having another cesarean, it's that, in fact, what happens is that women become afraid of labor.
Yes.
Yeah, and that and the stress of that makes it very difficult for them to give birth.
But I have helped quite a number of women having vaginal birth after cesarean, and with great, wonderful statistics. And I recently had a young woman this year I helped as her doula. And she had planned a hospital second birth because subsequent to her surgery the first time, which may have resulted because of some possibly unnecessary interventions that occurred, she was told by the surgeon that her uterus was platypoid, which is more flatter uterus, and that she must never attempt a vaginal birth. She could never do that. And this pregnancy, 2 years later, she saw an obstetrician in an Oakland hospital. And this physician told her that she, without even performing a physical examination, told her that she had a protruding sacral prominence, telling her once again there was a block, that her pelvis was defective. So she went into her labor with a fair amount of anxiety, but chose to labor at home as long as she felt comfortable and then go into the hospital. And she had a lovely home birth, a lovely hospital birth with a larger baby. And there was absolutely nothing wrong with her pelvis.
There was nothing wrong.
But she had been, there was fear induced.
So what I'm hearing a few things. I'm hearing that, well, actually, this makes me ask another question, because what it sounds like I'm hearing is part of the reason that there's an increase in cesarean operations. Of course, this doesn't explain why the first cesarean comes through, but in general, that women have been made afraid mm-hmm. of giving birth, and that the fear and the environment in the hospital, which is also fear-inducing and not conducive to having less stress hormones, is making birth more difficult. So women are doing that. But the other thing I'm hearing is that that some women are just not well, they're not getting educated properly. So is there a higher percentage of cesareans performed on women of low socioeconomic status?
Actually, according to some of my reading, it's
the other way around. That's interesting.
Yeah, women, older women who have private insurance and are better educated.
They just don't want to mess with the birth process.
Yeah. Now, the infant mortality rate is high with the underserved population because of the lack of education, the lack of good nutrition.
Prenatal.
And the lack of emotional support. But, you know, fear of birth, Marie Mongan in her book Hypnobirthing does a very good job tracing the history of fear of childbirth from 3,000 years before Christ, when nature was celebrated and birth was a joyous occasion. And those that were celebrated were Mother Earth, Mother Creator. Just there was great joy around birth, and even Aristotle and Hippocrates wrote nothing about pain in labor other than during a complicated delivery. And 79 years before Christ, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Soranus, he wrote about no pain in labor, and women in Greece were still treated kindly and respectfully in labor. Aristotle and Hippocrates advocated support for women in labor, and they really wanted to accommodate their needs. So you didn't hear anything, very little, mm-hmm. about discomfort in labor, mm-hmm. and women were offered herbs and brews to make them
induce
more comfortable.
Induce labor, no?
Yeah, mm-hmm. and then with the rise of Christianity, the belief of...
Talking to your microphone, sweetheart.
Okay.
Thank you.
Also, the women... There was this belief, because conception was not properly understood, there was a belief that women willed babies into being. Huh. And so they were considered connected with the divine. So women...
Well, it's kind of true, isn't it?
Well,
it's kind of true.
That.
Yeah.
And so with the rise of Christianity and the promotion of a single male God, there was no room for this connection with the divine.
I'll say. Well, we've moved into also a scientific rather than folk medicine or body-based or matriarchal kind of approach to everything that has anything to do with health, which has really moved us away from having any kind of natural experience. So what you're saying is that it's very important for women to hear this, that it is a myth. And there are probably some women sitting out there saying, oh, yeah, I was there, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. That labor has to, you know, that labor is painful, that birth is painful. That one of the things we talked about in preparation for the show was the fact that people sometimes misunderstand. They're just not in touch enough or embodied enough in this culture to understand the difference between intensity of feeling and pain. And so they're frightened. So part of what we're saying is, cesareans happen because women are afraid of birth. They're roped into it, and that there are reasons why they're afraid. But might we also talk a bit about what's wrong with having a cesarean birth? Because, I mean, from my perspective, it's primarily, this is like open abdominal surgery, and I don't think women realize. But you want to make a different point first?
I want to make a couple of points.
Yeah, go ahead.
I do want to put a word in for the folks that really care who work in the hospital. I was very recently at a long, difficult labor where the nurses at our local hospital, Sutter, were just so compassionate, and the doctor was so holistic in her approach to my client.
That's good news.
That there are a lot of wonderful providers out there in the hospital setting, and I'm very grateful that they are there. So hospitals are not always, you know, horrendous. A hospital birth does not have to be a horrendous experience. And I think a key there is that the clients have advocates, that they have a doula or a midwife, or they have a doula being a continuous caregiver who is there as their advocate.
What's the difference between a doula and a midwife?
Doulas, according to DONA, the doula certifying, one of the doula certifying bodies, they're not really trained to do internal exams and to do the medical part of care for a pregnant woman, whereas the midwife provides full-scope care, prenatal care, care during the birth, during the labor, and postpartum.
Okay, so midwives are more highly trained. They have more education, and they're licensed. Okay, so did you want to try to take on why cesareans might not be the first option?
Okay, well, definitely not the first option, and it concerns me, this issue of elective cesarean, because I believe that a lot of women are...
You need to get closer to your mic.
Okay, how's that?
Yeah, great.
Okay, a lot of women are unaware of what they are embarking upon, what they're really calling in when they choose to elect for a cesarean. It's major abdominal surgery. There are risks within the surgery that there could be nicking of another organ, of the bladder, even of the aorta.
Takes a long time to recover from surgery, and you're also under general anesthesia sometimes.
Not always. A woman can have an epidural where she's awake mm-hmm. and she would get to see her baby.
But there are effects on infants.
Oh, sure.
Of those drugs. You mentioned the difference between, you were comparing natural birth babies to medicated and cesarean births. You're talking about crawling to the breast after.
Yeah, there's a wonderful short video, delivery self-attachment, where it shows how a non-medicated baby will, placed on the abdomen, will find its way to the breast and within 50 minutes will be suckling, whereas a medicated baby will be somewhat disoriented, and it shows that baby just kind of turning its head and having some difficulty finding its way.
And by medicated, we don't mean that the baby is literally medicated. We mean the baby is medicated because the mother's
through
medicated.
The mother, sure.
You're listening to your own health and fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm in studio with Constance Miles. She is a licensed midwife and an RN, among other things, and we are discussing this epidemic of cesarean births, these cesarean operations, and I think you wanted also, so problems with, one of the, let me just sort of recap what I think we've said. We've said that the increase may be due to a lack of good information, a lack of good prenatal support, a kind of mythology around how painful birth is, and some women just don't want to be there when it's happening in a certain kind of way, so they and then the doctors are frequently probably overly concerned about complications. Is that
because
fair
of
to say?
Liability?
Because of liability, and it's also quite an income stream for hospitals.
That's right.
Yeah.
There's financial incentives.
All right. So there are circumstances where a cesarean may be necessary, but certainly not at the level of not at the amount that we're seeing currently. So when would you opt for a cesarean? Given your preference for a natural vaginal
birth. A male position, you know, on rare occasion, the baby comes down into the birth passage with its head off at an angle, and it just gets stuck there.
Okay.
And, you know, that might be a time if a woman has some kind of an obstruction, like a fibroid tumor, if that the baby cannot pass by. If there's a placenta previa, where the placenta covers the opening to the cervix, the baby, that would be necessarily a cesarean delivery. Also, if there's an abruption, a tearing away of the placenta before the baby is born, the mother could hemorrhage, the baby could die. But these are statistically rare. Also, if there were a cord prolapse, that would be another reason. If the cord
collapsed,
came out before the baby, that would be another reason for a cesarean.
Drops out.
Yeah.
Just in terms of statistics, another thing that I mentioned to you when we discussed the show is that a lot of women are very frightened of the idea of a home birth. But you've been a midwife for 35 years. Is that correct?
Yeah, I haven't been providing primary care that long, but I have been involved with birth that long, and I've never lost a baby.
Okay, so I hope people hear that in your experience, all these many, you know, couple and a half decades of delivering with home births, you've not lost a baby, and you've never lost a mother. Go ahead.
There are some websites I'd like the listeners to know about.
We'll post these on our website as well.
Okay.
Jeffrey, did you have something?
I was just going to say, we do have them on our website.
Yeah.
Okay. So, would you like me not to?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. There's an article, the North American Registry of Midwives collaborated with two Canadian researchers, Kenneth Johnson, an epidemiologist, and Betty Ann Davis, who was the project manager. And in 2000, they did a survey of certified professional midwives in Canada and in the United States, and they this survey was reported in the results of the survey were reported in the British Medical Journal, which is a prestigious journal that only prints about 19% of the submitted articles. And it talked about how for a low-risk woman having a normal birth, that the outcomes were so much better when she had a home birth with care provided by certified professional midwives, rather as opposed to having a low-risk birth in a hospital setting where there would be far many more interventions. I think there was a 3% cesarean rate in the study.
When they said better outcomes, what concretely were they measuring that by? How were they evaluating that?
5,000. The participants were 5,418 women expected to deliver in 2000, supported by CPM, Certified Professional Midwives. 12.1% were transferred to the hospital after labor began. 4.7% had epidurals. 2.1% had episiotomies. 1% had forceps. 0.6% had vacuum extraction. 3.7% had cesareans. No mothers died. So that was how they figured that a woman, a low-risk woman having a planned home birth, stands a chance of one-tenth to one-half less chance of interventions than were she to birth within a hospital setting, according to this survey.
So what it sounds like is that they were measuring this by what kind of interventions had to happen in order to bring the birth to completion. Were they looking at any postpartum outcomes, evaluation of
how well
the women recovered,
the child too,
or effects on the child?
That I do not know, but this study can be accessed on www.midwife.com/cpm2000.htm.
We're going to have to break in a second, but when we got on the phone and we talked about this issue, you were extremely passionate about it because you've seen the difference between these different births. You've seen the hospital setting. Even good hospital settings are distracting, and there's too much light, and there's so I was saying to you, gosh, Candace, I mean, this is Constance. Why did I say Candace?
Okay.
Constance. There's this history of women, and it still happens, actually, up to the very moment they're up and walking around, and then they get this feeling, and they crouch, and they, you know, I mean, not every woman does this, but there's in the developing world, it's much easier for women to give birth. And you were talking about all the different ways that women are supported and they're not distracted and not frightened by birth.
Michel Audin is a French doctor who used to have a birth center in the south of France in Pithiviers, where women would actually birth in water frequently, or at least labor in water. And we've been very fortunate to have him as a guest at a number of our conferences, guest speaker. And he talks about how bright lights, a lot of conversation, a lot of fussing with the sheets or busyness around a woman in labor stimulates her neocortex, the frontal reasoning part of the brain, and takes her out of her primal rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
If she's allowed to just drop down into her primal rhythm with birth, she's more likely to deliver quicker and without problems.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand. So we need to take a very brief musical break. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm in studio with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and why am I doing this thing with your name? Constance Miles. It only happens if I know somebody well. Constance Miles, M-I-L-E-S. Did you want to give out some kind of contact information?
Sure. My email address is moonsong@sonic.net. My home phone, 707-874-2888. And I hope by the end of the month to have my website more refined, womensways.com. www.healthinnovationsinc.org.
Okay, and we'll give that out again in a moment. Okay. So we're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. We're talking about cesarean epidemic and natural birthing. And if you stay with us, we will return with more. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. If you missed parts of today's show, you can go to our website and listen to it all week at yourownhealthandfitness.org, where you'll also find information on the Progressive Health Observer, Radio on Demand, where you can download archives and articles. And you can also call 707-874-2772. We are doing a lecture event called Protecting Yourself Against Stress-Related Illness this Sunday from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. in Berkeley. To find out more, again, go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, or call 707-874-2772. Now back to our interview with Constance Miles, M-I-L-E-S, and we are discussing cesarean epidemic and natural childbirth. Constance, you wanted to alert people to a few links, a few websites where they can find out about events that are coming up. If you could just, you want to do that?
Or? Sure.
Okay.
The California Association of Midwives, CAM, is going to have its annual spring conference in Occidental first weekend in June. So you can look them up on the web. And MANA, M-A-N-A, the Midwives Alliance of North America, both CAM and MANA have lists of midwives. And Citizens for Midwifery, their website is cfmidwifery.org, and they've got quite a number of papers which can be downloaded about the safety of midwifery care.
Okay, and we'll have Jeffrey, if you can give all this stuff to Jeffrey, he'll load it up.
Already there.
Well, some of it might have to be switched. Go ahead. Go ahead.
There's also the International Cesarean Awareness Network, ICANN. There's APA, the Association for Pre- and Perinatal Psychology and Health, APPPAH. And I wanted to also mention NOCIRC, the National Organization of Circumcision Information Resource Centers. And Hensie Goer has authored a couple of good books, The Thinking Woman's Guide to a Better Birth, as well as Obstetrical Myths and Research Realities. Ina Mae Gaskin from The Farm in Tennessee has a very practical, informative book, Ina Mae's Guide to Childbirth.
Yeah, we'll get that up on the website for people for resources. You wanted to discuss laws and low-income women.
Okay. My state license, California midwifery license, is a license that the medical board awarded us, but it's a license that we cannot be 100% in compliance with because there's a clause in there that states that we have to have a supervising physician. And we believe that midwifery is an art unto itself and would much prefer to have the wording be a collaborative or collegial relationship with a physician. Because of the supervising physician clause, many LMs are having difficulty obtaining lab work for their clients. And there's no Medi-Cal reimbursement, which limits the access to care for low-income women. Home birth is out of the question.
And hospital births are extremely expensive. I mean, they're just amazing. Somebody was saying that they're like between $40,000 and $50,000 for hospital birth, something like that. I mean, which is just shocking. So that means that if you're forcing low-income women into the hospital to have their birthing and they don't have health insurance, who's paying for that?
Right.
You know, I mean, is it all, it's all going on Medi-Cal, I guess. Is that what's happening?
So we would like to be able to serve the underserved.
Well, it would make perfect sense. I mean, in the developing nations where their birth mortality rate is lower than ours, where they actually have easier births, ironically, this is one place where the developing world is in much better shape than we are. Families rally, and this is, like you said, a joyous event, and women are not afraid, and they're mentored by each other and cared for. Yeah, there's a lot of prenatal stuff that has to happen. I mean, I'd like you to talk a little more about what midwives are able to do. I mean, you mentioned that you've got, you're carrying equipment, you're more able to monitor a situation if it gets to be scary during a home birth. So why don't you first of all talk about what sorts of things that you carry with you, what kind of monitoring you do, and what happens if there is an event where it looks like maybe a woman is bleeding too much or you have to get her to the hospital.
Okay, well, first I'll start with prenatal care.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, some people
That's a happier stuff.
Some people come to us for preconception care, and we may look at their diet, nutrition, exercise, their emotional support. It's a very holistic approach to a woman's health. And then prenatally, we see a woman. The schedule we see our clients is usually every 3 to 4 weeks, the first 7 months, every other week in the 8th month, and every week the 9th and thereafter. Usually babies come, I think 2/3 of babies come within 42 weeks, but it's we prefer to see them come within 42 weeks, not to go beyond, largely because the skull bones ossify and then they won't mold, they won't overlap and fit through the birth passage that readily. So prenatally, we have a woman weigh herself, we'll have her check her urine for protein, spilling sugar.
Yeah.
You know,
make sure she's
we
not
do
getting
that.
Diabetic, yeah.
Check her blood pressure, pulse, measure her uterus for growth, and listen to the baby's heart tones and palpate. We put our hands on her belly and we assess the position of the baby, and we do this monthly, and we check in with her about her diet, her exercise, her sleep, her hydration, if she's having any headaches, visual problems, any constipation, any swelling. We'll check her shins for swelling. You know, we do a pretty thorough assessment, and we do that throughout the pregnancy. And then during the birth, during the labor, we monitor the baby's heart tones, take a baseline blood pressure, and
You also carry, you mentioned that you prefer not to use it, but if you have to, you have oxygen with you.
Oh, that's right.
And you have you have hemorrhagics in case there's some bleeding. And you have some other monitors that you have with you, apparently.
We also do lab work prenatally. I do have an account with the lab, and I'll do a blood draw. And I carry IV equipment. On occasion, I've had to hydrate a mom at home. And
why are you, I know that, you know, oxygen, people don't realize that we breathe oxygen. Or oxygen breathing, but very pure oxygen, there's a price tag for using it because there's a lot of free radical production with a lot of oxygen. You know, you don't want to be breathing pure oxygen for long periods of time, so that's probably the reason. We also talked a bit before about some of the kinds of prenatal screenings that are used in conventional or industrialized medicine, like lots of ultrasounds and doing the amniocentesis. And I remember doing a show about recovering from birth and about birthing with another midwife many years ago. And she talked about how there are ultrasound pictures of babies during amniocentesis waving needle away and pushing away at the needle and shrinking back. So they're very frightened by that. It's not a benign situation. And you mentioned that the ultrasound, although sometimes it's necessary to use, should not be used too much because it heats the uterus and the baby.
Well, it has been, Sarah Buckley writes about this in her best practice books, about how it, she's from England, and how it can change the shape of eggs in the ovary and what's it doing to brain cells when it's held for a long period of time over the abdomen in the area where the baby's head is.
So is your preference then, do you recommend to people that they use it only as necessary and try to avoid just having like pictures to show people of their baby?
Yeah.
For entertainment purposes?
Yeah.
So when would you...
There are times when it is appropriate.
Like?
Well, if there are twins, if you're suspecting twins, you want to know. I wouldn't want a surprise in a home delivery. Twins are not within the scope of our license.
So you don't do home birth with twins?
I haven't myself. If there's a breech baby, you know, if I suspect that there's a breech, I would want to have a good look and see if indeed this baby was breech and probably try to turn the baby if possible.
Yeah. How would you do that?
External version can be done, listening to the baby, getting the woman
What's
very
external
relaxed.
Version? Mean you massage?
Just massaging the belly.
The tummy.
I myself have not done this, uh-huh. but I have witnessed it done.
So sometimes a midwife can do that in a home birth if there's a problem? They can turn the baby around?
Well,
I know that people do that with animals.
Not during the birth so much, you know, to vert a breech. You've got to term baby and...
This is your own health and fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and Constance Miles, M-I-L-E-S. She is a California licensed midwife and registered nurse. You can reach her by email at moonsong@sonic.net.
.net,
uh-huh.
Yes.
And your home phone number again is 707-874-2888. That's easy to remember. You had wanted to make some comments about circumcision. I mean, there's this issue also about, when somebody births at home, too, I wonder what happens with all the vaccinations. One of the things that happens in hospital environments is that they come at you with a lot of stuff that's very scary. The baby has a lot of stuff done to it initially, and I'm wondering whether that's less true in a home birth.
Well, we give our clients the option of the vitamin K shot.
Which is
preventive for hemorrhagic disease of the newborn. Some choose to have it. Some choose to have it administered orally, which we do three times, as opposed to having
scaring
an injection.
Scaring the baby with an injection.
If it's a more arduous labor or there's any bruising when the baby's born, we do encourage the injectable. As far as immunizations go, the Windsor Integrative Clinic does a wonderful panel for parents periodically where they have a couple of allopathic providers and some naturopathic providers, and they talk about the pros and cons of immunizing. And I encourage my clients to educate themselves so that they don't just make a decision knee-jerk, you know, that they really
Well, but it sounds to me as though you have a little more time in a home birth and a little more of a holistic approach in terms of personal decisions being made, like whether or not to circumcise. You're not pressured. I mean, there are other things, like they put eye drops in babies' eyes and they do lots of shots right
away.
People
can
wave.
People can wave all of those if they have the education and know what their rights are.
And isn't part of your job educating people prenatally on that stuff?
Yes.
So why don't you say a bit about circumcision from your perspective?
Well, 20,000 to 40,000 nerve endings in the most sensitive organ for a male body are severed and removed. And the work that Marilyn Milos and NoCirc is doing is just astounding. Worldwide, the rates are going down for circumcision of boy and girl, infants and children.
And you had given out that website again? That was...
Let's see... www.nocirc.org.
So one of the things that we talked a little bit about that you were a little less comfortable talking about, but I'm not, so maybe I will, is that people, women do contact me when they're trying to give birth and they're concerned about fertility and they want some advice. And I'd like to, if it's okay with you, go ahead and give out some of that information
from
my perspective.
Yeah.
The main thing that Dr. John Lee, who's losing, people are now not knowing about him so much since he died a couple of years ago, and he was the real pioneer with natural bioidentical progesterone use. He was one of the major pioneers, but he was also a family practitioner who had a practice in Northern California for 30 years and used natural progesterone in his practice. And you knew him, of course you did. Yeah.
No,
I used natural progesterone also. Yeah, bioidentical. Yeah,
Organic Excellence, the wild yam cream.
Yeah, well, actually, the wild, it has to be, my experience has shown that if it's just the yam is, it needs, you don't have all the precursors to turn it into progesterone, so it's better if it actually says it has bioidentical progesterone in it, not just yam. But John had in his home office a wall behind his desk of babies, and these were women who contacted him because they were infertile. Mm-hmm. And they were anticipating doing fertility treatments and were frightened by doing them. And John treated them by rebalancing their hormones by adding in some transdermal natural progesterone. And even after birth, you know, for postpartum depression and all that. And he talks about that in some of the old shows that we did together that are on our website. But the point is that many women are infertile because either their thyroid is underactive or they have a thyroid disease that isn't been diagnosed. So they need a thorough workup on their thyroid also because thyroid hormone is so important for the brain development of a child. And indeed, if a woman has more estrogen to progesterone ratio, if their progesterone is very low, they won't conceive. Now, cases where you see this happen a lot are women who have what Jeffrey talks about a lot, which is metabolic syndrome. Women whose blood sugars are too high, and as a result, their insulin levels are too high. And insulin, being a hormone involved with sugar transport, has an effect on the sex hormones. And what it does in women is it causes the follicle to produce testosterone instead of progesterone. So no progesterone is produced. The progesterone gets very low. The testosterone gets high, and the immature eggs turn into cysts. So you get polycystic. It's polycystic syndrome where they have little cysts all over that burst and are painful. These women are infertile and often have no periods. But if you introduce, instead of birth control pills, which is what conventional medicine often does, which makes the problem worse in the long run, transdermal bioidentical, meaning matches the molecular structure of what your body makes, progesterone cream at sort of reasonable amounts. It's going to vary from woman to woman. A saliva test is a good way to get your free, unbound levels to see what the tissue sites are actually getting in terms of progesterone instead of blood tests where they spin the serum and then the progesterone is spun out. So saliva testing will help to figure this out. A couple of other concerns are, generally speaking, this issue of diabetes that happens during gestation. So women do need to be careful about sort of comfort foods. I know a lot of women say, well, I'm pregnant, I'm going to get big, so I might as well eat whatever I want, you know, but that's actually really not a good idea. It's really a good idea to make sure that you're eating really good whole foods and enough protein and balanced with, as you said, enough of the alkalinizing foods like vegetables and fruit. So you get all the flavonoids and all those good foods. Yeah, go ahead, Kat.
We have our clients fill out a diet diary and do a fair amount of nutritional counseling.
That's wonderful.
And see that they're getting what they need from the different food groups.
Now, there are people listening to us all over the country, and so they're going to have to find their little clinics here and there. But you've given them a bunch of websites so that they can start to get referrals. But the point is that that and also something that you talked about a lot, which is to really understand the stressors in your life if you're anticipating pregnancy, because your body, you will not conceive if you're stressed out. Your stress hormones are protecting you from having a baby. If you go back to the fight or flight, you're running from a predator that's going to eat you or it's going to hurt you, that isn't a good time to reproduce. So your hormones are not going to be conducive to getting pregnant or conceiving.
So we encourage meditation, mm-hmm. some form of regular exercise where the hormones of well-being, the natural opiates of the brain, the endorphins, are produced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so watching for hormone balance, examining, as you put, you brought up a very important point in our conversation about being sure that everybody is on board with the pregnancy. You know, making sure it isn't just, oh, well, whatever you want, and then secretly I don't want it, or after a woman has made a decision to have the baby, then is there ample support, and are there people who maybe she wants a home birth and they're not on board with the home birth?
And sometimes not everybody will be on board. I had a client this year whose partner was kind of fearful of having a child because of his own childhood. And he so fell in love with this baby.
Yeah, how could you not? Beautiful, if you really see the baby when it's born, you can't.
We don't encourage coercion. You know, there really does need to be respect mm-hmm. for everybody's
autonomy. But most
men,
if they're there at a birthing, I mean, Jeffrey, I mean, you're an example. Jeffrey you have daughters and you have grandchildren and you've been at births and stuff. Do you want to say anything about that?
Well, my youngest daughter was, as I was telling Constance when she came in, my youngest daughter was born in hospital, but I was present, which was not the case with my oldest daughter, and it was a wonderful experience. I was the first one to hold her. Mm-hmm. It was great. And my oldest daughter had home births for both of her children.
And she has wonderful children, too.
And it was just this great experience for everybody. So I think it makes absolutely perfect sense.
My first daughter was born unassisted 35 years ago, which means we lived in a mountain community where there was no doctor, no midwife, and I'd read everything I could get my hands upon. And I was very fortunate that everything was smooth with the delivery, and I've since attended her at home several times, and her second birth was a Braut presentation, and it was a complicated delivery, and we stayed at home. Everything went well. But she never once thought of going anywhere else, mm-hmm. you know. And mm-hmm. I was really touched
by
that.
Historically, women had no alternative, and people did reasonably well. It isn't the case that there was enormous mortality around death in the past. I mean, the statistics now are pretty disturbing compared to what happened before. I want to make another quick comment before we run out of time about postpartum depression, because it is one of these things that we talk about on the show that is a symptom that's been turned into a disease, and in fact is not a disease. And even in conventional research, they cite the fact that this is a hormone imbalance, because after you give birth, you dump your placenta, and all these hormones go out. The progesterone goes with the placenta. The placenta is carrying a lot, and unless you actually literally eat your placenta, which some people are willing to do, I guess, and some not, you're going to lose all that progesterone. And when you very sharply and very abruptly lose all that progesterone, progesterone is calming and sedating and helps with pain management and sleep. So you've got an estrogen, high estrogen, low progesterone scene. And estrogen is very excitatory, makes you very weepy and nervous and depressive. So the most obvious thing, and again going back to John Lee's work, MD, his website, johnleemd.com, is still maintained, and there's still articles there. There are shows on our website with him. But it is to add again in some very, you know, very modest dose of transdermal progesterone. He said to women who were breastfeeding, the only thing it will do is make the baby a little bit sleepy, which is going to be good anyway. You wanted to comment.
Yeah. Nancy Burns and Joan Logan are two therapists locally who specialize in treating women with postpartum depression. And most midwives offer extensive postpartum care as well. I offer 6 postpartum visits spaced over 6 weeks, because I feel like that is such a significant time for the woman and the family.
And what do you see mostly? Do you see a big difference between home? Well, you mostly tend to women who have had home births. So do you see a very modest amount of postpartum depression in these women?
I see more emotionalism with women who have lost the dream of their home birth, and they've had to deal with complications or a cesarean.
Mm-hmm. So
grief. Unexpected cesarean. Yeah, they have to process their grief and That's what I see. I did many years ago. I had one woman when I wasn't doing as thorough postpartum care who was very depressed. I found out months later, and she'd had a parathyroid problem. Oh. And once she got on meds, she was much better. But they came to visit me passing through town and told me. And I hadn't known because I hadn't done as many visits.
Yeah. So why don't you give out your contact information again and your website and give out your phone number and your email twice so people can reach you?
Okay. My name is Constance Miles, and my number is 707-874-2888. My email address is moonsong, M as in mother, O-O-N-S-O-N-G, at sonic.net. And my website, which is in process, is womensways.org.
And my understanding is that you're also conversant in using herbal medicine and other things in your practice with women.
I bring herbal tinctures, and I also bring homeopathy. It depends upon the woman, what she views as an ally. Some women are more comfortable using homeopathic remedies, and some prefer herbs.
And I'm sure that the environment that they prefer at home while this is all happening varies remarkably, too. Is there a favored position for birthing? Is it on all fours? Or
it's unique to every woman. And
Because I've read things about how you don't want to be, you know, lying on your back is supposed to be the worst.
I had one mama that was standing in the shower when her baby came out.
Wow.
It's very,
that's
very
great.
Varied.
So you just sort of take your cues from the woman.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for coming
thank
in
you,
and
Linda.
Sharing this very valuable information. And
thank
I hope
so
that people
much.
Will be brave enough to examine the possibility of having their children at home so that it is this familial and ancient sort of ritual and celebration. I want to just quickly re-announce the fact that Dr. Fawcett and I will be doing a two-hour lecture event in Berkeley this Sunday, March 4th, from 4:30 to 6:30, called Protect Yourself from Stress-Related Illness. To find out more or to get tickets, you can call 707-874-2772 or go directly to our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day, again, 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, the Progressive Health Observer, and Radio on Demand, where you can download archives and articles and shows, go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. Again, you can also listen to the show every week for free there. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.